Cold Air Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
You're welcome on into Friday's edition of Kildare Focus. In just a moment, we'll be talking about a new Irish Penal Reform Trust report, which says opportunities to improve outcomes for children with a parent in prison are being missed. I'll be joined by the charity's regulator, Helen Martin. The 2020 report is being released showing over 400 concerns have been registered with the regulator. John Sweeney is Emeritus Professor at Maynooth University, and he says changes have gutted the climate bill. Donal Buggy of the Irish Cancer Society joins me. He's urging anyone affected by the disease in Kildare and who needs to talk to reach out to the Irish Cancer Society for support. And we'll be hearing about the family trees and relationships of fictional characters in movies, TVs, series and books with Dr. Amin Ajam Shosa of Maynooth University. That is, of course, we always want to hear from you. Get in touch with your comments, your requests, your dedications by text or WhatsApp to 083 97 97 97. You can drop us an email if you wish, studio@kfmradio.com, and you can always tweet us at KFM Radio. Now, a new report by the Irish Penal Reform Trust says opportunities to make better the outcomes for children with a parent in prison are being consistently missed. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Fianna Ní Chineada. She's Executive Director of the Irish Penal Reform Trust. Fianna, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks so much, Ciara.
I suppose this is a group of people to whom society in general pays very little attention, because if we're going to talk about the prison system, the focus is almost universally on those who are incarcerated or those who work in the prison system.
Exactly, Ciara. And I think that's why the children and families of prisoners are often described as the hidden victims of the situation. And this was echoed yesterday by Dr. Niall Muldoon, the Ombudsman for Children, who himself said that children with parents in prison are often the forgotten victims of crime. And it's important for him as Ombudsman for Children to remind our state and our society that they need to be supported. And we know what the impact is on these children. There's the trauma of separation, there's stigma, there's increased prevalence of behavioural issues, mental health issues, poverty, adversity, and poorer outcomes overall. But I suppose the other piece is the importance of supporting the caregivers, be it the parent on the outside or the foster parent or the, you know, the person who's providing the caregiving environment for the child on the outside. And just to say also, Ciara, that this is supported by, you know, the international, so the children's rights framework. So under the UN Convention for the Rights of the Child, it's very clear that children have a right to access where it's in their best interest, their parent, no matter the situation, and that there should be no discrimination of children on the basis of the status of their parent.
I would imagine that if anybody considers the child of a person who is in prison, what they consider is the act of visiting that parent and how traumatic or not that may be for the child. Are there any concessions made in that process to the age of the person visiting the prisoner?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And I suppose at our seminar yesterday, we heard from a range of experts who, you know, identified that all children are different and all children will be experiencing this differently. But what was widely acknowledged is really that while measures were previously made in the Irish prison system to make changes and improvements to make for child-friendly visiting environments, it has obviously stalled. Now, this has been a terribly hard year for children across Ireland, but the trauma has been multiplied for children with a mother or father in prison, and many of these children have not had physical contact with their parents for well over a year. The Irish Prison Service did bring in very positive moves. They introduced video calls to replace the in-person visits. Apart from a few hiccups and bumps now, it hasn't been perfect, but we do admire they did that. The other thing is there's been the installation of phones in cells so the children can speak directly with their parents and the parent isn't, you know, on a line on a landing trying to communicate with their child. So that's good, but nothing replaces in-person physical contact for a child with their parent. I mean, and even the short response we got from families, one of the most heartbreaking things I heard was a mother describing her child who has a 6-minute call, and they, you know, the beep goes and the call dies. There's a 6-minute call to communicate with their parent in prison, and they don't have time to finish their story, which is incredibly sad. So much more needs to be done.
I know that Ryan O'Rourke, writing in the Irish Examiner in very recent days, with a very, very moving, very powerful piece on his experience as a child visiting a parent in prison. And he said these visits are often marred when they occur in person, as they certainly did in his experience. They're often marred by underlying attitudes of aggression, discrimination, and a deep, unmistakably Irish feeling of shame. And that experience will hit every child differently, but will also affect them differently dependent upon the age that they were when their parent went to prison.
Yes, I mean, I suppose we're definitely not child psychology experts in the Irish Penal Reform Trust, you know, but you can imagine a very young child. So, for example, prison visits have just restarted in two of the male prisons this week, and under the restrictions, the guidance there. So it will be two sides of a screen. Certainly the adults will have to be masked and gloved, and the visit can only last a maximum of 15 minutes, and only one parent, one child can be brought along. So you have parents or caregivers deciding which child can be brought to the visit after over a year, in most cases, of in-person contact. And what we're hearing is people who are saying, on one hand, they want to see their loved one in person so they know they're okay and to let them know they're still there for them. And on the other hand, you have people saying, you know, 8 hours of travel, round trip for 15 minutes and those could you, how is a small child going to understand why they can't hug their parents that they haven't seen in over a year? I mean, it's pretty devastating. And we would wonder whether it's actually proportionate to risk, particularly where you have belatedly, but thankfully, the rollout of prison vaccination. So if you have people vaccinated on the inside and the risk has been reduced, is it necessary to have such high infection control measures in that environment, which, after all, is not a hospital and is not a nursing home?
I note, Fiona, that this report is effectively an update on a report released in 2012, and scores of recommendations made in the original report have yet to be actioned. What are your keynote recommendations that need to be actioned now?
Absolutely. So we are clearly calling on the Department of Children to put together a working group to look at what needs to be done for children across all, for these children and their caregivers across all government departments and agencies. Almost everything here always comes back to joined up thinking. Mm. And who we would like to see at the table includes, for example, schools. So, you know, it's very important that the privacy of families is respected, but at the same time, we do need a wider awareness of the really positive role that teachers can play in these children's lives, you know, the one good adult and stability, and very important to include these issues in anti-bullying policies. We also need to see access to very specific support services for families who choose it. I mean, this is the other thing that came up yesterday. Not all families need services and support. Not all families want them. Maybe they'll want them in a while, you know. So it's very important that it's driven by what the children need and what the families need and want. But we do know that people are falling between the cracks, and the stigma means that people don't often reach out for help. There are great models in Ireland. There's a great project called Bedford Road that's been operating for a long time in Limerick. We have New Directions that's based in West Dublin, also doing very good. But these are, you know, if you don't live in the catchment area or near those supports, particularly people in rural areas, we don't know how they would know where to start.
Well, Fiona Ní Chnéide, Executive Director of the Irish Penal Reform Trust, thank you indeed for joining us.
Want to get in touch with your favourite show on KFM? Text or WhatsApp us now on 0833 97 97 97.
The charities regulator has released the annual report for 2020, showing over 400 concerns about charities or people purporting to represent charities were expressed. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by the Chief Executive of the charities regulator, Helen Martin. Helen, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much. It's lovely to talk to you today.
And we're delighted to have you here. I would imagine that the number of contacts made with your office, Helen, last year was down significantly on previous years.
The number of concerns were down. They, I wouldn't say they were down significantly, and certainly in terms of overall contacts that we had from charities and things like that, we were still kept, all of us kept very busy. They were certainly down to some extent, though, in terms of concerns. So they, these would be the issues that people are raising with us about charities. But that was to be expected, really, with the year that was in it, you know, where people had were focusing on a lot of other things, and also as well, a lot of the charities that were out there were really struggling to deal with the pandemic itself and how they were going to continue to provide services. And as look, as you pointed out there, we did receive over, I think it was 466 concerns is what we received last year. But just to point out to listeners that, you know, just under 40% of those related to entities that were not one of the 11,400 or so charities that we have. And we did run a campaign late last year with An Garda Síochána, because most of those concerns around legitimacy of an organisation relate to clothing collections. So they'd be the labels, you know, that we all get through our doors. And what I would be saying to everybody, and the guards have joined us, and we were really, really appreciative of that, you know, in telling people just to be very careful when you're making donations in response to those. There's a charities register, charitiesregulator.ie. You can go on there, check the name of the charity, check to see that they are registered. Because if it is your intention to give to charity, it's important that that is what happens. But unfortunately, a lot of those leaflets that come through your doors will not be for legitimate charities. And as a result, that can lead to all kinds of issues. You know, the kind of issues that local authorities are dealing with all around the country associated with fly tipping. You know, if you've got an organisation that is trying to hold itself out as being a registered charity when it's not, and it's looking for these kind of donations from you, I think, you know, it would be a bit naive to expect that they were going to treat those donations in a way that was responsible. And so, as I said, there can be all kinds of societal issues associated with that. So just to say to the public, you know, just to be aware that, you know, this is a regulated sector. The charities regulator is there. And just to check our website, and also check with charities yourself if you have any queries. Charities can be more than happy to talk to potential donors.
Of the concerns raised with you, Helen, that pertained to charities that didn't have anything to do with Bogus clothing collection, what kind of other headings were we looking at here?
Well, one of the main headings that would have come in, and this would be similar to other years, would have been around the area of transparency and financial controls. And we did a survey earlier this year where that came out really, really strongly in being something that people were very conscious of. And it does affect the level of trust and confidence that members of the public have in charities. So we've been working with the sector and also with our parent department to try and increase levels of transparency across the board. So each year, charities return information to us. It's as part of an annual report, so they'll tell us all about what they did in the previous financial year. And that some of that information is available on our website. So the members of the public can go in there, they can see about the finances of charities. We would like further detail on that, but unfortunately we do need some legislative amendments first. But what we do is that we do urge registered charities themselves to make full accounts available on their websites so that members of the public can go in there and see what they've actually done in the previous year, because it's in everybody's interest, the charities and members of the public, that charities tell their story and can, you know, can stand over what they've done in the previous year. A big thing for us when we look at issues in charities is to make sure that the charitable assets, that's, you know, vehicles, premises, money, whatever, that all of that has to go to delivering on a charity's charitable purpose. And when we talk about charitable purpose, I'm conscious probably a bit of jargon here for your listeners, what we're talking about is, what was the charity set up to achieve? You know, was it set up to advance education? Was it set up to relieve poverty or economic hardship? Is it doing something of benefit to the community, you know, in the health sphere, on the environmental side? And if, you know, it's set up to do those things, and it has to stick rigidly to what its purpose is, its charitable purpose is. So it shouldn't be spending any money or, you know, using its resources for anything else other than what they were set up to achieve.
Speaking of setting up, almost 1,000 organisations added to the register of charities last year. That seems like a huge number.
Yeah, I think for the year that was in it, there was a lot of surprise about that. To be honest, they weren't just COVID-related charities. I think there's probably an assumption for a lot of people, oh, well, that's because we had a pandemic and people were struggling to set things up and get out there and to assist, you know, their local communities and nationally. But that wasn't the case. Certainly, we would have had applications from organisations that were prompted to set up as a result of COVID. However, in a lot of cases, we were contacted by people who were trying to do that. And what we would have done is steer them towards an existing charity, because the registration process is quite a robust process. It's not a rubber stamping exercise, and that is, you know, proper that it is that way, because there's significant responsibilities for people who set up a charity and who are overseeing a charity. We call them charity trustees. So if you're sitting on a committee of a charity or on a board, you'll totally understand where I'm coming from in terms of the responsibilities that you have. But in terms of what we saw, as I said, they weren't all COVID related. A number would have been schools. Schools are charities. They're required to register with the charities regulator. And others would have been the kinds of charities that we see year on year. I'm kind of at the end of the process where I'm registering the charities. Mm. And it's brilliant to see the kind of work that's going on out there. You know, we'd have local responder, emergency responder groups. You would also have groups that are setting up to maybe get people living in their locality to cancer appointments, so they'd be providing a kind of transport service. Now, admittedly, those kind of things would have been very difficult last year because of the restrictions the charities were trying to work with. But it didn't put people off. You know, people who had an idea and were in the registration process before the pandemic remained very much committed to that and continued with the registration process.
Well, Helen Martin, Chief Executive of the Charities Regulator, thank you indeed for joining us there. Certainly a very busy year for that regulator. Over 466 concerns about charities or people purporting to represent charities reported to that office, and 912 new charitable organisations registered. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking about the gutted climate bill, and the Irish Cancer Society wants you to get in touch if you need support connected with the disease.
Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
Now, Stop Climate Chaos has described the climate bill as having been gutted in reaction to the final debate to the bill in the Dáil. The bill will enshrine, once it's enacted into law, an interim target to reach a 51% reduction in carbon emissions by the end of this decade, and intends to set Ireland on the path to net zero emissions no later than 2050. And to discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Professor John Sweeney. He is a climatologist and also an emeritus professor of geography at Maynooth University. John, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
Would you be aligned with that sense, that opinion of Stop Climate Chaos, that the climate bill has been gutted?
Well, I think I was probably the originator of the phrase.
Yes, then.
But what happened was the climate bill has gone through a number of very serious iterations between the Dáil and the Seanad over the past several months. And at various stages, a number of very sensible amendments have been made, I think up to 90 or so, and almost all of those have been rejected. I think only two have been accepted. But at the very last stage of the bill, in the Seanad, before it went to the Dáil for final approval, the government inserted an amendment. And that amendment had the effect of retaking control by the government of how we measure, what we measure emissions, and also what directions the Climate Change Advisory Council had to comply with. And the consequences of that from a scientific perspective were, in my opinion, quite serious, because there were a lot of concerns that what was happening here was that political control was being, inserted over the objective scientific methodologies which globally and within Europe were applied to what we measure, how we measure, and how in particular we attribute withdrawals from the atmosphere by sequestration. And that was the chief concern which I think the NGOs had in the lead-up to the final passage of the bill on Friday evening. There was some assurances given by the minister that, in fact, they would comply with the Paris Agreement obligations. They are not as tight, if you like, in terms of compliance that most NGOs would have liked to have seen. Mm. And of course, once the thing is written into law, then future ministers are entitled to reinterpret that a little as they see fit. So that was the chief concern which led to that statement. And let's hope that it's now something which will be overcome when our carbon budget is being finalised shortly.
Does that a key amendment, one of dozens and dozens, as you've noted, John, does the effective imposition of political suzerainty over that of objective scientific evidence, does that render the bill completely pointless? Does it contain any merit yet?
Well, I think No, I wouldn't say it's pointless. I think it's giving more discretion to the government of the day and the minister than most of us in the scientific community would like to see. Now, I think the fact that the bill is passed is a good thing. We really needed this bill. We needed to see serious steps being taken to reduce our emissions. The 51% commitment by 2030 is a very welcome development. Mm. But what is important is the accounting procedures that go along with that. And I think it's very important that we actually reduce emissions and we don't start trying to offset our emissions against, shall we say, less clear-cut removal systems, which don't really force us and don't really require us to take the drastic changes in emissions that we now require. We're looking around the world today, of course, at places like Germany, places like Oregon, even you may say places like Ireland at the moment, and seeing that, you know, we're seeing extremes, and those extremes are very much the kind of early warnings of climate change. They may not be associated directly with climate change in the short term, but they're what we would expect to be seeing as the jet stream becomes more unreliable. And as the atmospheric circulation responds to the changes in its composition that we're making to it. So there's no need for, there's no justification for any complacency. We have to follow the science in this area, just as we have to follow the science in the pandemic story as well. And once we start politically interfering with the science, we run the risk of, if you like, exposing our population to unnecessary risks in the future.
Well, Professor John Sweeney, member of Antashka Climate Committee, Emeritus Professor of Geography at Maynooth University, thank you as always for your time. Thank you, Teresa, for your absolutely lovely text. I hope you have a great weekend too. And do remember that if you want to get in touch with your comments, your requests, your dedications, 0833 97 97 97 is the way to do it. Now, the Irish Cancer Society is urging anyone in this county, or indeed any other across the country, who's affected by a cancer and who wants to talk, to reach out for help. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Donal Buggy, Director of Services with the Irish Cancer Society. Donal, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, and it's great to be with you.
We're delighted to have you here. What has prompted this reaching out by the Society?
Yeah, so I think we have been seeing over the last 18 months the impact of the pandemic on people who have cancer or who are impacted by cancer. We're seeing increased distress, increased worry, some of the concerns that people before had been able to talk to their nurses and their cancer care teams about. They just haven't been able to get to those conversations like they have in the past. So as a result of the fabulous support that the Society received through Daffodil Day in 2021 and the Late Late Show special, we have been able to almost double the funding that we are putting into counselling in 2021 to ensure that anyone who is impacted by cancer, anyone who needs support to help them with the psychological impact of a cancer diagnosis will be able to get some help.
And how will people be able to access those supports, Donal?
The easiest way to access those supports is to call our free phone nurse line, and that's 1-800-200-700. And when you call there, you'll speak to an experienced cancer nurse, and she will go through the process with you of either linking you with a virtual counsellor, So that's from the comfort of your own home, either by phone or by video call, or to link you with a counsellor in your local area who you can visit and have a counselling session with.
And I suppose to that end, despite the pandemic, the Irish Cancer Society, Donal, was able to fund 333 counselling sessions here in Kildare last year. I imagine you could easily have doubled that and there may still have been need.
We could easily have doubled that, and we want to double that in 2021, because we know that, you know, more than 800 people in Kildare will be diagnosed with an invasive cancer this year. And we're really only scratching the surface in terms of the number of counselling sessions that were provided in last year. So what we're asking is that anyone who is impacted by cancer, whether at the moment or indeed in the past, and wants that support, it's a free service, and it's very easy to access by calling our cancer nurses. And again, the number is 1-800-200-700.
Do you think perhaps, Donal, that the people don't necessarily equate a cancer diagnosis, and I'm speaking absolutely in generalities, don't necessarily equate a cancer diagnosis with an impact on their mental health or their ability to cope, regardless of the gravity of that diagnosis?
That can be the case, and particularly when, you know, you're going through the treatment phase and you have, you know, your various steps going from one treatment session to the next treatment session, and you have that plan in front of you. But a lot of times what we find is that at the end of treatment, people realise not just the impact that it's had on them physically, they start to think about the impact it's had on them psychologically. And what we would say is that it's very important to, in terms of your future quality of life, that it's not just that you're well physically, also is to consider being well mentally and helping you to deal with the challenges in relation to, you know, what happens if this cancer comes back, how do I have conversations with people around my cancer diagnosis, and how do I deal with the emotions that arise when you have you've gone through such a traumatic and a challenging period in your life.
And the Irish Cancer Society's free phone support line is 1800 200 700. Irish Cancer Society Director of Services, Donal Buggy, thank you indeed for joining us. Now, there's seemingly an ever-growing interest in genealogy of family trees and relationships. But have you ever thought about the relationships and interrelationships of fictional characters? My next guest certainly has, and has conducted a huge study on this basis. I'm joined now on the line by Dr. Amin Anjamshoa, a Lero Marie Curie Fellow at Maynooth University. Amin, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hi, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
I'm delighted to do so. You have created family trees for all manner of fictional characters, from Ulysses to those on the cobbles of Coronation Street. What possessed you to do this?
Oh, yes. So, during the quarantine, the idea struck me when I was watching some TV shows, and I felt the need to have the family tree. So it could be nice to have the relationship between these fictional characters that's in front of you, and have better relate to the movie or series that you are watching. And I searched online. I had a few resources. I found a few of them, but there was not a resource that gave us this information in a uniform way. So, and surprisingly, I found out that this information are already captured in open data resources such as Wikipedia and Wikidata. So I thought, okay, I should do something useful with this beautiful data. And that was the origin of this project.
But when you mined it, essentially, you still had to stitch it all together and make sense of it. That sounds like a vast task.
Yes, this is the next step. You should just present this data in a way that's visually appealing and attractive. So this is what the pipeline of the data processing behind. We are just already sitting on the shoulders of giants. So we have some beautiful data set, and the thing that we did was that in a nice way present this. On the other hand, this was also good thing for my family, because we turned this into a family project. So I just collaborated with my wife and my son, which was responsible for the quality control. And we all together could turn this corona disaster into a productive time.
And did your son have any particular family trees that he wanted to look at in the world of fiction?
Yes, he's very interested in Harry Potter and all these cartoons. So he was especially keen about these and looked into these and just showed me the mistake and say, okay, here this relationship is not correct, or this is missing in this family relationship. And he helped a lot. So he was very, very excited about this project.
I would imagine family trees for some kinds of franchises or movies or very short miniseries wouldn't tax most people. But when you're taking on a behemoth like Coronation Street, I think it's the world's longest running soap. I mean, your family trees could be literally as tall as an oak.
Yes, that's correct. So the family trees are just the background story of books, series and movies, and many of such relationships are captured in Wikipedia or other data sources. There are some situations that part of this data is missing. So by doing this project, I was hoping that if some missing relationship is found in a movie, so the movie fan go to the open source and say, okay, this relationship is missing, and in some way the open data community can indirectly profit from this project. But there are already many such family trees of the books of series and movies already captured in Wikipedia, and that's what we benefit from.
And the sheer number of people that have contributed to the open source data caches from which you have drawn these family trees is staggering. 500,000 people around the world.
Yes, there are lots of people are contributing to this. Also, there are this data is existing in 300 languages. So in some way, the Wikidata and Wikipedia are one of the biggest crowd source projects around the globe, and it is still every day new relationship, new information are added to this big knowledge source, and not just for the movies and so on. So this is also for the medical information, for many other fields. You can find useful information in Wikidata, and the quality is day by day improving.
Was that part of the attraction of this kind of project for you, Amon, that it draws on what is effectively living information that can change day to day and is contributed to by so many people from so many diverse backgrounds, cultures and languages?
For me, this project was very interesting because, as you said, this is just a live data set contributed by many people. On the other hand, I'm doing more than 15 years of research in semantic dev, linked data processing. But this project was in a way special for me because on one hand, the result was directly communicated with the general public. So instead of publishing, writing journal papers, was directly communicated with people, and I really enjoyed that. I received very good feedback from the people. On the other hand, it's just raising awareness about open data. How important is that? Not just for this project, for movies, family trees, but in general, what can open data do to the community, to the society, and what other fields this data can be used for? So I'm very happy with the result. I received very good feedback from public, also from experts that says, okay, this is a nice way of using open data for a nice use case.
And where can we see this collection?
Okay, so the website is available under linkedpeople.net, and when you go there are three categories. There is the movies, series, and books. You can search the through these categories. You can search for a character. You can search for a title of the artifact, for instance, the movie title or the book title. And for the movies, you can also look for the person who has played that role. So all three ways is possible to find your artifact, and then by browsing that, you can just interact with the tree and just focus on one person and find out more about that person. And it's also linked to the external resources.
It sounds absolutely fascinating. Thank you indeed for joining us to share your work with us. That is Dr. Amin Anjamshoa of LIRO and a Marie Curie Fellow at Maynooth University. My thanks to you all for your company as ever, not just today, but throughout the week. Special thanks to Kildare Focus producer this week, Owen Beattie. Don't forget, packed weekend of Kildare sporting action. The hurlers take to the pitch tomorrow, and the men's and women's footballers in action on Sunday. Stay tuned to us here on KFM throughout the weekend for live commentary and updates.